320-0202, People of the State of Illinois, Appellee versus Christopher L. Krum, Appellant.
Ms. Solstock, am I correct?
Correct, yes. Okay.
You may proceed.
May it please the court, counsel, Erin Solstock from the Office of the State of the Appellate Defender for Appellant Christopher Krum. At trial, Christopher Krum's defense counsel put forward two affirmative defense theories, self-defense and second-degree murder. However, counsel's performance was arguably ineffective where counsel failed to call two crucial witnesses who could have bolstered the defense's theories by explaining how Krum's post-traumatic stress disorder led him to believe he was acting in self-defense at the time he stabbed Melvin Buckner. As preparation for trial, counsel sought out two expert reports from doctors Terry Killian and Robert Meyer of Krum prior to trial, and they both diagnosed him with PTSD. Both the reports also indicated that his symptoms likely provided psychiatric mitigation regarding the instant offense and discussed the fact that that Krum is one of his symptoms is marked hypervigilance and a deep-seated belief that one has to constantly stand up for oneself for fear that others would see his weakness and attack. Unfortunately, counsel did not call these witnesses to testify at trial, though. Our Supreme Court has held that as the defendant's perception of danger, not the actual peril, which is dispositive of a defendant's need for self-defense. Moreover, both the self-defense and second-degree murder statutes make it clear that these defenses depend on the belief of the defendant at the time of the incident. Here, we can see that Krum's PTSD diagnosis would have provided the jury with a much better understanding of why he believed he was in danger at the time of this altercation with Melvin Buckner.
So is there a standard here? Is there a reasonableness standard at all, or is it just accepting his belief?
There were two defenses here, right? So one of his defenses was whether or not the self-defense, you know, it was both whether it was unreasonable or reasonable, right? Because he provided affirmative defenses of both second-degree murder and self-defense. So second-degree murder can include an unreasonable belief of danger as well, whereas self-defense does depend more on the reasonableness. However, here, counsel had put forward both affirmative defenses. So either way, this PTSD diagnosis and the symptoms that Krum experienced because of his PTSD would have contributed to his personal belief of whether he was in danger. In Whiters, which is an Illinois Supreme case, our Illinois Supreme Court said it is the defendant's perception of danger, which is important in evaluating whether the defendant needed to use self-defense. So the defendant's
perception could be unreasonable and it'd still be defensible.
I'm not sure that Whiters talks about whether it's an unreasonable perception of danger or not. It talks about what the defendant's own perception is. So we look at the defendant's perception and what it looks like to them. And PTSD in this case absolutely contributes to what Krum believed was going on at the time of the offense and what he needed to do to respond. And the problem here is that the jury never was able to hear any of this evidence. Instead, they only heard Krum's version of the events, in which he did explain that he was acting in self-defense and that he believed that he was in danger. However, there was nothing to corroborate this, that his version of the offense, and there was these witnesses could have been called to explain why Krum believed the things that he testified to, and also why he then felt he needed to act in the way that he did when he was approached by Melvin Buckner. Additionally, I think it's important to consider the fact that Buckner and Kroom had had an earlier altercation in the evening. So Kroom's perception of danger was actually tainted by that earlier altercation where Buckner was adamant that he was an opposing gang member and the two men had to be separated by friends. And, you know, then were Buckner was taken by a friend to walk it off and was told, you know, we don't need anybody getting arrested here. And his own friends were telling him that he needed to calm down. So I think that there was other evidence that did support the fact that Buckner was could have been the one who instigated this altercation. And then given Kroom's hypervigilance and understanding his own mental state, that could have led the jury to actually believe Kroom's version of the offense. Additionally, I think we need to consider the jury note that was sent out in this case. The jury sent out a note during deliberations that said, do we all need to believe that mitigating circumstances was present? And do we need to all agree that mitigating circumstances was not present? This note shows that at the very least, the jury was struggling with the second degree murder verdict, whether Kroom was guilty of first or second degree murder. They never would have sent out this note if they were not split on the issue of mitigating circumstances. There was no reason to ask this question if everyone agreed that there were no mitigating circumstances to warrant a second degree murder conviction in this case. But this note shows us that the jury was split. And given that they were split on the issue of second degree murder versus first degree murder, we can see that it's arguable that these expert witnesses could have changed the outcome at trial. And because this is just a first stage PC, we are only looking at whether it was whether counsel was arguably ineffective. It only needs to be arguable that it was unreasonable for him to not introduce these witnesses. And we only need to believe it was arguable that this could have changed the outcome at trial.
Counsel, aren't you speculating about what the jury did here? I didn't see anything that said when the jury sent the note out. It might have been a diligent foreperson who wanted to make sure the instructions were read correctly as opposed to the product of compromise or the product of the consideration of that evidence. Was there anything else in the record that I may have missed that shows that this came at the 11th hour of deliberations? Or something else that might have supported your argument?
Well, we know it came during deliberations because there was more than one note that was sent out. So this was during the course of deliberations. Also, I would say as far as your the fourth person was being over diligent and asking about whether everyone needed to agree, that was actually, you know, that question is already answered by court instructions. Jurors are very clearly instructed that verdicts need to be unanimous. So there's no reason to ask a question specifically about mitigating circumstances and whether everyone needs to be in agreement about this one specific thing, unless there was something going on in the jury room regarding the mitigating circumstances and some discussion. It doesn't seem to make sense that the jury would send out a note just asking about mitigating circumstances and needing to agree on that in particular, if they were just confused about general jury instructions to begin with. Why would they ask about this one thing, but not other things? It definitely shows that there was something, I think this shows that there was something going on about the actual mitigating circumstances and whether the jurors agreed or did not agree on that. Personally, never read a record in which a foreperson sent out a note to be proactive to get clarification, or seen that in a record before. So I would say it's much more likely that the jury as an entirety agreed to send this note out. And the other thing I think that this note indicates is that the jury didn't necessarily believe the state's entire version of events. they saw some sort of mitigating circumstances here, at least some of the members of the jury did, and they wouldn't have sent this note about mitigating circumstances if they believed the state's entire story that Melvin Buckner had instigated had not instigated this, and that Kroom was the one who instigated this altercation. If they had believed Kroom approached Buckner and thrown the first punch, there's no reason for them to ask about mitigating circumstances, being in agreement about mitigating circumstances. Some of these jurors believed that there were mitigating circumstances, even with the evidence they were shown. So I think we can see that if they were also given this PTSD evidence, which is highly, highly relevant to this specific offense, especially just because of, you know, the hit Kroom's personal psychological history and the fact that a lot of the violence he experienced in his childhood was between men, and often he had witnessed men dying in front of him, both as a child and later in life in federal prison, he had experienced a lot of violence between men. And so that's actually where his PTSD comes from. And we can see how that could have played out in this specific instance with Melvin Buckner. Additionally, I'll just briefly talk about the next issue regarding the lynch evidence that counsel failed to introduce. With regard to that issue, counsel failed to introduce Buckner's domestic battery conviction, and appellate counsel should have raised this on direct appeal. With regards to this issue, there's no reason in the record that counsel would not have introduced this evidence. Counsel actually sought the court's approval and motioned to introduce this conviction under Lynch to show that the defendant had a propensity for violence, and he was permitted to introduce this. And then when it came time to actually introduce this evidence, counsel just completely failed to do so. There's no explanation in the record as to why he did that. However, there's also no reason not to introduce this evidence. In Lynch, our Illinois Supreme Court has explained to us that Lynch evidence can affect the jury's judgment of how credible the various versions of the facts were. And here the entire case rested on whose version of events the jury believed, whether it was the state or the defense. So any piece of evidence that would have made the jury more likely to believe the defense's version of events, such as this domestic battery conviction showing Buckner is willing to use violence against his own family members, someone in his own home, we can suppose that maybe he is willing to use violence against an opposing gang member when feeling like he was being disrespected, which is what was indicated in the record. So with regards to that, I believe it's arguable, given the other facts in this case, that this Lynch evidence could have additionally arguably swayed the jury to believe Kroom's version of the offense. And if you don't have any other further questions, I'll just summarize and conclude now. Kroom's counsel was arguably ineffective here. His claim meets the minimum standard to survive a first stage, Kroom requests that his petition be remanded for second stage proceedings, including the appointment of counsel. And I would also like to reserve a few minutes for rebuttal, if that's all right.
Well, you will have 5 minutes in reply.
I have one question, Justice.
Oh, yes, of course.
Counsel, please remind me, is there an IPI on the Lynch evidence issue?
I do not recall if there's an IPI on the Lynch evidence issue. I could definitely look that up and get back to you, but I do not recall at this time.
I didn't recollect whether there was or not, but okay. Thank you.
I'm sorry.
Any other questions? No. Okay. Ms. Krapf, you may respond.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Kelly Krapf, and I represent the people of the state of Illinois in this matter, people of the state of Illinois versus Christopher Kroom. This court should affirm the trial court's first stage dismissal of defendant's post-conviction petition, as the trial court properly found that the petition was frivolous and patently without merit. As opposing counsel said, defendant addressed two matters in his brief regarding the trial court's dismissal of his petition. The first, he alleges that the trial court erred by dismissing the petition because its counsel was ineffective for failing to call expert psychological witnesses who would testify that defendant suffered from post-traumatic stress disorder. And next, he alleges that the trial court erred by dismissing his petition because he received ineffective assistance of appellate counsel due to appellate counsel's failure to raise on direct appeal, trial counsel's failure to present evidence of the victim's prior domestic battery conviction, and the alleged error by the trial court to allow evidence of the firearm. As the state argued in its brief, these arguments should be rejected. The state first makes the argument in its brief that these arguments, the argument regarding ineffective assistance of counsel, should not be reviewed because it is barred by the invited error doctrine. Under the invited error doctrine, a defendant may not request to proceed in one manner and later contend on appeal that the course of action was in error. For the doctrine to apply, the defendant must affirmatively request or agree to proceed in a certain way. And here, it can be inferred by the record that there was an agreement between defendant and defense counsel not to call these expert witnesses. There was one, a statement of intent that was filed on February 8, 2016. And that said, now comes Christopher Croom by one of his attorneys. And it goes on to say, it is the intent of the defendant not to call Dr. Killian. Along with this idea not to call the witnesses. Also, there was a hearing on February 24th, 2016, in which defendant was present, where defense counsel stated that, quote, we filed a notice, a statement of intent. We filed it on February 8th, statement of intent. Expert witnesses intending not to call it trial in the merits, Terry M. Killian and Robert Meyer. During this hearing, defendant was standing next to counsel, and he did not give any indication that this approach, that he disagreed with this approach that was going to be taken by his attorney. As the state argued in its brief, defendant should not be allowed to agree with the decision not to call the witnesses for trial, and then on appeal, complain that the decision was an error.
So in other words, as long as the defendant agrees with ineffective assistance of counsel, it's okay?
Justice, what the state is arguing is that the defendant agreed with the strategy not to call the expert witnesses. Clearly, the defense hired especially one of these experts, and there would have been a discussion with the defendant, between counsel and defendant, as to what these reports indicated. And the reports were very clear. One of the things that it appeared that the defendant was wanting was to maybe find an expert that would find him unfit. Neither of these experts found him unfit. They said that he did have some signs of post-traumatic stress disorder. But obviously, in the state of Illinois, as everyone on the panel knows, diminished capacity defense is not allowed in the state of Illinois. So they were hopeful that they could find someone that could say that he was unfit. They did not find that.
That's pretty speculative, isn't it?
That they would want someone to find that he was unfit?
I mean, that's your argument inferentially, right?
Well, my argument is that the opposing counsel's brief and the argument is barred by, and defendant's argument is barred by, the invited error doctrine because he agreed with the procedure not to call these witnesses and that they would have reviewed what the witnesses would have said in their evaluation of the defendant and made a decision, trial strategy decision, not to call them as expert witnesses. The defendant was there for the statement of intent as well as during the hearing and would have known that these expert witnesses would not have been called. There would have been a thorough discussion about this. And if the defendant did not agree.
That's assuming you have effective counsel, right?
The defendant relies on the counsel for advice and the advice of the attorney. The advice of the attorney would have been, after taking a look at the evaluations, that this may not have been in our favor, as I argued in my brief, to necessarily present this evidence. And they made a strategic decision to not present this evidence. And that's how they decided to go forth in this. We could even argue that our argument, the state's argument, is that counsel was not ineffective, that this was a matter of trial strategy. And that is why they decided not to put forth these two expert witnesses. And I discussed that all throughout my brief. And I would even go as far to say that even if PTSD evidence was available, as I was mentioning, it is a matter of trial strategy, because although attorneys do have an obligation to explore readily available sources of evidence that might benefit their clients, and failure to investigate and present available witnesses to corroborate a defense has been found to be ineffective assistance, decisions concerning which witnesses to call at trial and what evidence to present on defendant's behalf ultimately rests with trial counsel. So when we want to talk about if you had a counsel that was ineffective, these decisions ultimately rest with trial counsel as to what would be the best strategy that we put forth for our client at this time. So it is well established that these types of decisions, what witnesses to call, are considered matters of trial strategy and are generally immune from claims of ineffective assistance of counsel. And we even mentioned a case in our brief.
But they're not immune, they're generally so. That's what that quote says.
It does say generally. Yes, correct. Correct, Justice.
And we're at first stage here?
We are at first stage, yes. And the state recognizes that the bar is low, but one of the cases that opposing counsel mentioned in the brief was this case of People versus Tate. And from our argument, this case is not a situation where defense counsel neglected to, for instance, as in People versus Tate, investigate a potential defense. That is not the situation here at all. In Tate, our Supreme Court reversed the summary dismissal of a post-conviction petition, holding that a trial strategy argument by the state was not appropriate for the first stage of post-conviction petition because it was arguable that the defendant was prejudiced by his attorney's failure to investigate or call two witnesses. In this case, even if you want to make an argument that we would just say that you cannot even argue that he suffered prejudice. So if you want to say, for instance, it's not barred by the invited error doctrine, ineffective assistance, defendant here cannot establish that he was prejudiced by any decision. There was no indication that he is not the one that stabbed Mr. Buckner. It was very clear, in fact, that he did. The evidence pointed to that. And so in addition to failing to establish that it was arguable that his attorney's performance was deficient, defendant fails to make an arguable showing that he was prejudiced in light of the overwhelming evidence against him. Although he does contend that the testimony from the medical experts about his PTSD would have been crucial to establish he was acting under a reasonable or unreasonable belief in the need for self-defense, defendant's subjective belief that force was necessary is just one of the elements of a self-defense claim. So you would have had to establish other elements as well. Moreover, the defendant took the stand in his defense. He was able to explain to the jury what he thought, what he felt at the time, and the jury did not go along with the idea of a self-defense claim on that matter.
But there wasn't any explanation of why he felt that way, correct? Other than his statement, he did feel that way.
There wasn't any explanation as to why, Justice Holdridge, he felt, what's that? I'm sorry?
Why he felt that way. You were just talking about that. You're saying he took the stand. He said, I felt this way.
He was able to explain all the occurrences that led up to the moment before he ended up stabbing the victim. He had the chance to explain that to the jury, and the jury did not go along with his story. And even during closing arguments, the defense counsel did make a strong argument for defendant, but the state was arguing that about self-defense, that for a person to be justified in using self-defense, they basically cannot start it, okay? The defendant would have to reasonably believe that his conduct was necessary to defend himself against the imminent use of unlawful force. The problem is he wasn't defending himself against unlawful force. He was attacking Mr. Buckner. Sneaky, tricky, but he was not defending himself when he stabbed him in the chest. The truer fact found the state's argument more convincing than the defendant's. And just because the defendant was found guilty does not mean that his counsel was ineffective. And the state wants to also touch on the opposing counsel was discussing that jury note, and Justice Heddle was mentioning, asked a question about that. And the state wrote in its brief that the defendant does misrepresent the jury note, as he contends that evidence of his PTSD could have swayed any conflicted jurors. During deliberations, juries wrote this note. It said, "Do we all need to agree that mitigating circumstances were present? Do we all need to agree that mitigating circumstances were not present?" As you heard opposing counsel argue, this note would indicate that the jury was split on this issue of whether defendant was guilty of only second degree murder. Defendant was not privy to the negotiations of the jury. None of us are privy to the negotiations of the jury, either the state, the trial court, no one is. Defendant's claim is based purely on speculation and certainly cannot support his assertion that the jurors were split on the issue of whether defendant was guilty of only second degree murder. In regard to the ineffective assistance of counsel claim on the first issue, the state would say that he was not, trial counsel was not ineffective. Moving on to the second issue is the allegation that the trial court erred by dismissing defendant's petition because he received ineffective assistance of appellate counsel. Due to appellate counsel's failure to raise on direct appeal, trial counsel's failure to present evidence of the victim's prior domestic battery conviction, as well as the alleged error by the trial court to allow evidence of the firearm. In regard to the firearm evidence, the state submits that since defendant was found not guilty of this charge, appellate counsel was not ineffective for not raising this issue on direct appeal. Obviously, appellate counsel would have taken a look at this, saw that he was found not guilty of this charge, and made a strategic decision that this was not something that they would want to put and argue on appeal. So the state would submit that that argument in regard to the firearm is not relevant, or is without merit. And the state would argue that appellate counsel was not arguably ineffective as to the first issue as well in regard to the domestic violence, the lynch evidence. One of the things that opposing counsel wanted to discuss was there was really no reason why defense counsel did not bring the domestic violence issue up. However, there was much discussion regarding whether the victim's prior domestic violence conviction should be admitted into evidence. It was from 2007. And as I said, there was a lot of discussion as to whether this should be admitted into evidence or not. And one of the things that the trial court even said was, even if defense counsel brought this issue up and we were able to establish self-defense from defense counsel's standpoint, he didn't even know if he would then, the trial judge didn't even know if he then would end up allowing that evidence to be presented in the first place. He said that it could really, in a way, he said it could cut both ways. You could take a look at this. It was from 2007. He said that it could not end up benefiting the defense at all. And so he said, even if defense counsel was able to establish self-defense and was able to put forth a self-defense claim, he didn't even know that he would allow this evidence in. So the state would say, again, appellate counsel was not ineffective for not raising that issue. And again, it was just a matter of trial strategy. Decisions concerning what evidence to present on defendant's behalf rest with the trial counsel and are viewed as matters of trial strategy, as well as appellate counsel's position on that matter as well. So the state would say that appellate counsel was not ineffective for those reasons.
Looks like your time is up. I'm sorry, Ms. Graff, I should have called it. Your time is up. Would you like to just summarize or have you?
I would just say that in sum, the court properly admitted evidence of the gun. As I already mentioned, the evidence was relevant and appellate counsel was not arguably ineffective for failing to raise the issue on direct appeal as the issue was meritless. For the reasons that I stated in brief, I will stand on my brief, but the state would submit that defendant's arguments should be rejected and the decision by the trial court should be affirmed. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Any questions?
No.
No, okay. Ms. Shostak, you may reply.
Thank you. Just briefly regarding invited error, there is an abundance of case law in Illinois where our courts have explained that the invited error doctrine does not apply to situations of ineffective assistance of counsel. And we can see logically why this is the case, because otherwise, you know, anything that a defendant complains of as ineffective assistance, the opposing counsel can just say, well, it was invited because counsel did it. That it basically would negate the entire ineffective of assistance body of case law if we said that this was something that a defendant could not argue because of invited error. We have to look at whether counsel was ineffective or not. We can't just say counsel invited the error so they could not have been ineffective. I mean, that argument logically doesn't make sense, and that has not been accepted by many opinions in our Illinois courts, including in People v. Henderson, which is a first district case. They said that the doctrine of invited error blocks the defendant from raising the issue on appeal absent ineffective assistance of counsel. So I'm not saying that, what I'm saying here is that we just need to look at whether counsel was ineffective or not. We can't say that this was blocked by invited error, especially in this case, where Mr. Kroom actually filed several pro se motions during trial in which he indicated he disagreed with counsel as far as strategy decisions. There were several motions that Mr. Kroom filed. They were not specifically about the mental health witnesses. However, we don't know what Mr. Kroom understood at the time of trial about the reasons that these witnesses were not called. As Your Honors actually pointed out during Ms. Crapp's argument, that we don't know what the discussion was between counsel and Mr. Kroom. We have no idea if Kroom and counsel ever discussed whether these witnesses should be called. Kroom states in his petition that he did not agree that these witnesses shouldn't be called. And all we can do is take that assertion as true. That is all we know at this point. At first stage, we must take any assertions that are not rebutted by the record as true. And here there's nothing in the record that shows any explanation was given to Mr. Kroom as to why these witnesses were not called. There's no explanation on the record as to why counsel made this decision. Additionally, I would also just address—
Where would that, in these proceedings, where would that be disclosed if at all?
Well, that's the issue here, right? We're only at first stage. Mr. Kroom didn't have the benefit of counsel in preparing this petition. So he only put in what he, as a pro se petitioner, he felt he needed to substantiate his claims. In order to know why counsel didn't call these witnesses, we need an evidentiary hearing, which is why Mr. Kroom needs the benefit of counsel in second stage remand, so that we can know why these witnesses weren't called. Was it a matter of valid trial strategy? That's not an appropriate evaluation to make here at first stage. We know the Illinois Supreme Court said in People v. Tate. I know Ms. Kraft tried to distinguish that. However, I believe that case makes it absolutely clear that trial strategy is not something that we dismiss cases at first stage for. We don't know if it's trial strategy at this point because we don't know anything about trial counsel's decision-making process. We only know what the defendant has pled. I would also like to add that it, you know, trial strategy also shows, I mean, the state's argument is has a lot of contradictions in it. If it's invited error, they're saying it was defendant himself who invited the error. Then on the other hand, they're saying, well, this was trial strategy. It was counsel who made this decision. So who need an evidentiary hearing to figure out whether or not counsel's decision was unreasonable or not? I would also say that the discussion about whether Kroom's counsel, you know, tried to get these reports in order to show that Mr. Kroom was unfit, we don't know that that's the reason behind these reports. I did not personally see anything in the record that questioned Mr. Kroom's fitness to stand trial. So it's really very reasonable to believe that these reports were aimed to get a full picture of Mr. Kroom's psychological history and whether that could inform the case in any way. And then given the results of the reports showing that his PTSD could have affected his state of mind at the time of this offense, it's arguable that counsel was unreasonable for calling these witnesses. So for these reasons, we would ask for a remand for second stage proceedings.
Any questions? Thank you.
Yes, Ms. Sostock, you had mentioned that there was motions filed pro se at the time of trial. Was that mentioned in your brief?
I did mention that in the reply brief in response to
it's in the reply.
Yes. Yes. I believe it's also in the statement of facts, I believe, as well, of the opening brief.
And I don't have any questions.
Okay. Nothing further? Well, thank you, counsel, both for your arguments in this matter this afternoon. It will be taken under advisement. A written disposition shall issue. The court will stand in recess, subject to call.